From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Fresh back from our live event in Toronto over the weekend. Had a wonderful time. Packed theater at the Queen Elizabeth Theater. 1,100 cheering, screaming people. A lot of folks from the United States, too, but what a great time. We had Nick Pope, the ufologist, and of course Alex Jones with us. He brought the house down. We'll do it again next year too. If you haven't had a chance to visit us at these live stage events, try to follow us at coasttocoastam.com. Later tonight, Tales of the Bizarre. Here's what's happening. Well, as you know, over the past few months, we have been reporting on the Shemitah by Jonathan Cahn. He's reporting that September of this year would be a huge month for something catastrophic. He doesn't know what it is exactly. Could be economic, could be terrorism related. He just doesn't know. Well, it might be starting a little too early. Quite frankly, look what's happening to the stock market here in the United States. Equity markets capped a very horrible trading day to negative history and territory after shedding about $812 billion in market value. The Dow Jones Industrial Average wiped out 588 points, or 3.58%, down to 15,871. The S&P 500 dropped as well. NASDAQ dropped. They're all dropping. Everything's going down. Energies, something's happening. The Dow saw its biggest ever intra-point drop on Monday at the opening bell as it plunged. When it opened up, more than 1,000 points. Ms. Shedlock with us, the registered investment advisor. Boy, what's going on, Michael?
It's a valuation scare, and I think it's about time. Down 1,000 points in 10 minutes, the first 10 minutes. The NASDAQ was down 400 points, percentage-wise, 410 points. The NASDAQ was down almost 10% in the first 10 minutes. Remarkable volatility intraday. The NASDAQ actually went green around noon and then ended up closing down about 4%. The Shanghai markets, the sell-offs continuing over there. The Chinese stock market was over 5,000 mid-June. It's now flirting with 3,000, a 40% drop in a month and a half. Wow. But the futures, U.S. futures are up tonight. The Dow's up 300 points tonight. The S&P's up about 50. I don't know where they're going to open tomorrow, George. A lot of volatility here. Meanwhile, there's all kinds of things happening. I heard in the little tidbit right before we came on about a prediction of something major happening. 800,000 people have fled from Syria into Germany this year. What is Europe going to do with all these people they're offering? We've got this huge crisis in the Middle East. We've got a humanitarian crisis building. They're mostly pouring in through Greece. What is Greece going to do with 800,000 people? And China, we've talked about this. You've heard me mention this before. I kept saying China's slowing. The whole world's going to follow. A lot of things are hitting all at once here, George.
It sure is. Mish, thanks, and keep watching things for us. British authorities say that it was highly likely that at least 11 people were killed when a fighter jet performing in an air show slammed into a main road, with one ranking officer saying as many as 20 people could be dead there. Sad story. Researchers say they are closer to developing a vaccine to give long life protection against any type of flu after promising trials in animals. Two separate U.S. teams have found success with an approach that kind of zones in on a stable part of the flu virus. That should remove the problem with current flu vaccines, which must be given anew each year because they focus on the mutating part of the virus. Dr. Gary Ridenour, of course, expert on pandemics with us. Gary, this vaccine, what's your take on that? What do you think?
Well, right now it's more hype than it is hypodermics. Our current flu vaccine is a failure with an effectiveness of about 15%. George, would you buy a car with a 15% passenger survival rate?
No, sir. Not at all.
No, and our current vaccine is criminal. The theory of a universal vaccine, as you explained so well, would work, and it would be common to all the flu viruses, and that part doesn't mutate, and we would have a universal vaccine. However, last month, the U.S. Biomedical Research and Development Authority, called BARDA, shot down the flu industry's plans for a universal vaccine, saying that it was short of government standards. So what we're looking at is a universal vaccine is maybe a decade away, and then it faces technological, financial, political, and legal canyons to jump over.
Gary, I'm sure I'll be talking with you more about this vaccine and some other issues in the not-too-distant future in Texas. Just hours after Julie Mott's relatives mourned their loss at her funeral, grief struck once again when the young woman's body simply disappeared. It's believed that in the hours after the funeral service, someone came into the funeral home and stole her remains. The 25-year-old Texan died after a long bout with cystic fibrosis. The funeral home director told the affiliates that he believes the body may have been stolen by someone who simply did not support Mott's cremation, which was supposed to take place on August 17th. And a woman who took a bite out of another passenger in a dispute over a seat on a crowded subway in New York was being sought for assault. The attack occurred on a Manhattan-bound train from Queens earlier in the week when a 45-year-old woman asked the suspect, "Hey, remove your belongings, please, from the seat so I can sit down." Well, when the rider did not respond, the woman attempted to sit down anyway, and that's when things got out of control. Up next, we're going to talk about neurotribes, the legacy of autism in the future of neurodiversity. What does that all mean? Steve Silberman will explain next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. We're going to get your Monday into Tuesday off and running now. Steve Silberman is an award-winning science writer, author of Neurotribes, the legacy of autism and the future of neurodiversity. Now, he had a TED Talk in which his presentation was viewed by more than 800,000 different clicks, and his article, The Placebo Problem, won the 2010 Science Journalism Award for magazine writing. I want you to hear what he has to say with us today as we talk about autism, its rising rates, and just what the heck is going on here. Steve, first of all, I want to thank you for doing the work you've done.
Oh, thanks so much, George. I really appreciate it. It was the book took me about 5 years to write and research, and I originally thought it would take about a year, but once I started digging into the history that had been sort of buried over the years by some of the people who became famous for being autism clinicians, I kind of became obsessed with digging up the real story. So it ended up turning into a 5-year project.
Well, good for you. It's a subject that most of the mainstream media really doesn't touch, do they?
Well, you know, they might touch it, but it's usually you know, some kind of pity arousing story, or they'll say that, you know, autism is a mystery or a puzzle, et cetera. But, you know, I finally got tired of hearing that, you know, that it was a mystery and a puzzle. And I thought, well, after 70 or really 80 years of research, we must know something. So I started going back and digging back to really before the early days of autism research. And that's when I started uncovering some really interesting stuff.
Steve, set us on a track here. First of all, let everybody know what autism is.
Okay. Autism is a it's a developmental disability. People with autism have trouble in social interactions. They have trouble understanding facial expressions. They have trouble. Some autistic people are actually unable to use speech, although some of those people can use keyboards to communicate. That's the whole thing about autism. It's a very, very broad and diverse spectrum, as we say now, so that it ranges all the way from people who really would never be able to take care of themselves without constant care to CTOs in billion-dollar Silicon Valley companies with Asperger syndrome. So it is such a broad spectrum that no two autistic people are alike, and autistic people are more different from one another than non-autistic people are different from each other. So it is just about the widest swath of humanity you can possibly imagine. And that's one of the things that is so tricky about it, because it took a long time for science to understand how wide the spectrum is. And, you know, so now you hear, you know, Jerry Seinfeld went to see the curious incident of the dog at the nighttime on Broadway and said, oh, maybe I'm on the spectrum. And, you know, I doubt it, frankly. But, you know, people who are diagnosed with autism need a lot of help. They need special education. They need special kinds of support. Their families need support. They need resources. And it's really, really tough on families.
Is it a brain disorder? Is it an ailment of the brain? Where does it occur in the body?
Well, it's, you know, it's primarily genetic. I don't, you know, it's often called a disorder. I call it a condition in the book. Ailment is a, you know, a very loaded word. But what we do know is that most people who have autism are born with autism and have relatives who have autistic traits. And that's something that has proven itself time and time again. So it's a very, very complex condition involving both genes and possibly the environment, although no particular environmental factors have been discovered yet that, you know, that anyone has actually proved causes autism. But we do know that genes play a huge role, although genes are not the whole story, because you can have two identical twins who have who were born with identical DNA, but one turns out to be autistic and the other does not. So it's about as complex a medical condition as you can imagine. It's also, you know, by now it's become sort of a cultural identification, because people talk to other autistic people on the internet, and now people even diagnose themselves as Aspies or whatever. So there's like an autistic community that has formed on the internet. And but anyone who I've met with an official diagnosis, you know, who went through the process of having a clinical evaluation, they really are, you know, significantly struggling in daily life and need various forms of support.
Steve, does autism raise its head later on in life, or does it start almost from the get-go of when a child is born?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It completely depends. I mean, it's generally pretty obvious, you know, well, there are different forms of autism. It could be that there are many different subtypes of autism. Some kids are apparently autistic from birth. What's very, very common is for kids to start manifesting the symptoms of autism when they're two or three, and to apparently lose skills at that age, which is, of course, very alarming and upsetting to parents. And then kids who go on to be diagnosed with what we called for a while Asperger syndrome, although that term has been abolished, actually, in the most recent Bible of psychiatry, the DSM. Sometimes kids with Asperger syndrome are not diagnosed until they're young teenagers, because what happens is kids with Asperger syndrome can be extremely smart and precocious and chatty. And so, you know, the parents think, oh, my kid is just precocious and has really intense fascinations with the weather or with minerals or with Pokemon characters or whatever. Yeah. But then once the kid's peers start to become social and, you know, want to go on dates and stuff, then it becomes obvious that the kid doesn't know how to navigate the social landscape. And so they end up getting diagnosed with Asperger's. So Asperger's is kind of the latest manifesting form of autism. But most kids get, the parents pick up that something is different about the kids, like two, three, or four.
We're with science writer Steve Silberman. We'll take calls next hour, and hopefully if you know someone who is autistic, or maybe you might be, call us and share your stories with us on how things have been for you as you get through life. Out of your research, Steve, autism back around 1975 was about 1 in 5,000 kids. It is now 1 in 68? That's huge.
It is a huge thing, but the most crucial thing to remember is that when you say, you know, in 1970 it was this and now it's that, we're talking about two completely different descriptions of the condition. So, you know, now it's very common to refer to the autism spectrum. There was no spectrum in 1970. In 1970, autism was considered a very rare form of childhood psychosis. In fact, most psychiatrists blamed autism on bad parenting, which was horrible for families because they not only had to deal with the day-to-day challenges of raising an autistic child, they had to deal with the burden of shame and stigma for being blamed for making their kids autistic, which was, you know, of course, horrible. And that was the prevailing opinion among medical authorities in the 70s. Another reason why that was horrible was that the recommended course of treatment for autism was to put the kid in an institution to get them out of the toxic, allegedly toxic family environment that had caused the autism. And so, and parents were even advised to, you know, never speak of the child again, to quietly remove their pictures from the family albums and quote unquote move on with their lives. I had many, many parents that I spoke to, older parents, who told me that story, that that's what they were told to do. And so the kids would go into institutions, and it's not like there were, you know, luxurious autism wards in these institutions. They were state hospitals, custodial care, psych wards, straitjackets, drugs. One woman in at Bellevue, the chief of psychiatry at Bellevue in the 60s, tried all kinds of experimental treatments on autistic kids, including giving them LSD every day for, you know, like 3 months. And, you know, did these treatments work? No. You know, she also gave the kids electroconvulsive shock. Did that work? No. It would actually turn the kids into zombies, more or less. But autistic kids were practically defined as non-human, so they became sort of fair game for the most brutal kinds of experimental treatments. And not only that, because they were in institutions, because their families were told not to speak of them, they became invisible to the rest of society. So two generations of autistic kids disappeared into institutions.
Last year, a friend of mine came over for Thanksgiving in St. Louis, Steve, and he brought his autistic son with him, little tiny boy, and everybody loved him. And, yep. You know, he walked around, he introduced himself to people. What I found interesting about him, when my buddy was telling me about autism and his son, was that he was the little kid was extremely friendly with people, very open, but very inquisitive. I mean, he went up to everybody. What are you eating? What are you eating? Do you like it? And he'd move on. And is that a symptom of autism?
Yeah, autistic kids are extremely curious about the things that they are curious about, which is usually not a very broad range of things. But, you know, if they're into Disney, they want to know everything about every Disney character. And, you know, they'll watch one of the kids in my book has watched the same movie with his dad virtually every night for the last 10 years. And his dad tries to keep himself amused by noticing a new thing each time they watch it, you know, but it keeps the kid happy. And so, yes, in fact, that's actually a fascinating thing about autistic children is that they're very, very curious about the world in their own way. And it can come across as annoying because they're like peppering you with questions or whatever, but it's really their way of exploring the world in their own way and learning about what interests them.
If a person does not know about autism and meets an autistic person or child, would they pick up that there's something different here?
Yeah, but you know, as we've been talking about, you know, there's a saying in the autistic community: if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person, because autistic people are so different from each other. So it's, you know, there are certain sort of telltale, you know, signs, like many autistic people are not comfortable with sustained eye contact. So you might find that even though this person is standing in front of you, they're looking down or seemingly looking off, you know, to the side. And you think to yourself, well, you know, am I boring this guy? Or,
exactly.
He doesn't seem to be engaged. But actually, they're listening slant-wise, you could say. They're listening at an angle to what you're saying, perhaps very, very intensely, but they look like they're distracted. You know, so that's a sort of a telltale thing. Another telltale thing is that a lot of autistic kids flap their hands. It's a very distinctive autistic style of movement. But what they're doing is they're trying to regulate their energy. One problem in autism is that there's a lot of chronic anxiety, and autistic kids...
Let's talk more about it, Steve, when we come right back. Steve Silberman with us, NeuroTribes. We're talking about autism, a subject not a lot of folks will talk about on mainstream radio. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. Steve Silberman is with us, S-I-L-B-E-R-M-A-N, not Silverman, Steve Silberman. I bet a lot of people have confused that over the years, Stephen, huh?
I have been saying B as in boy about 15 times a day ever since I can speak. It's true.
I love it. So you're not a doctor. You're a science writer and a darn good one. Was it difficult for you to write a book about autism?
Well, here's the thing. I was used to the pace of magazine writing because I had been one of Wired's senior science writers for about 15 years. And so I got used to, you know, studying a subject for 2 or 3 weeks, which is a luxury if you're a newspaper reporter. I had also written Daily News before that for Wired News' website. But so, you know, I went from going 2 or 3 weeks into a subject to staying with the same subject for 5 years. And, you know, my book, it's a tome, I'll tell you. It's, you know, about 550 pages. The bibliography alone, which is on my website, is 36 pages. So, you know, I had to drill down through literally hundreds of papers and, you know, do a bunch of interviews with not only the leading autism authorities in the world, but also with families and autistic people themselves. And so I've really been living inside the subject of autism for at least 5 years. And you should see my living room. It still has not recovered. It's basically an archive of autism publications going back to the 20s, really.
Your research is everywhere. I love it.
Yeah.
What did you find in your work for you personally to be the most heartwarming when you were writing this book?
The most heartwarming thing was the book ends with by focusing on a guy named Mark Rimland. Now, let me tell you who he was.
Okay.
Mark's father was a guy named Bernard Rimland, and Bernard Rimland really overturned the notion that parents caused autism. And Bernard Rimland was a Navy psychologist, so he was not like an expert in the field. But as an outsider, he wrote this book that, you know, he felt that he had hardly even a prayer of getting it published, but he actually submitted it to a contest for a major psychology press, and the judges judged it blind, so they didn't know that Bernard was, like, not a famous expert in the field, and he won the contest, and they published the book, and so he transformed the entire field of autism as an amateur, really. He, you know, like I did, he became obsessed with researching autism, and I'll tell you a great story about Bernie Rimland. He went down to a convention of Navy psychologists or whatever down in New Orleans. And when his buddies, you know, went out drinking and, you know, whatever one does in New Orleans, he talked a guard at Tulane University Medical Library into locking him into the library for the weekend. And he lived on the chicken soup that came out of some machine.
Wow.
In the library. So his wife was alarmed when he went back to San Diego and he'd lost all this weight. But he basically felt that, you know, he could leave no stone unturned in understanding his son's condition. And so he had teams of Navy translators translating documents from Eastern Europe, et cetera. And, you know, he really transformed the field as an outsider and as an amateur. And he overthrew the notion that parents were to blame for causing autism. And so that was fantastic. But here's the deal. When Mark Rimland, his son, was very, very young, he was a very, very difficult child. He was self-injurious. He would batter his head against the walls of his crib so that he had a permanent bruise on his forehead. He would cry so much that the neighbors would call the police all the time.
Oh, my God.
And the police would come by and say, boy, I'm glad that's not my child, you know. And so Mark was very, very difficult. And, you know, Bernard wondered if anything good could possibly come of him. Well, here's the deal. I spent 2 days with Mark Rimland a couple of years ago in San Diego. Mark Rimland is now a middle-aged guy. He looks great. He's in great shape. He's a Special Olympics athlete. He swims every day. He's happy. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention, he was one of the models for the character that Dustin Hoffman played in Rain Man.
Huh,
so he was one of the real Rain Man guys. So, you know, Mark is just hilarious. He's witty. He's a very gifted artist. He gives art shows in San Diego. He illustrated a book that his sister wrote. And he was one of the happiest, most contented people that I've ever met. So, you know, all the kind of worst fears that Bernard and his wife Gloria had did not come to pass. And he, you know, he developed into a totally beautiful guy. Now, is he still autistic? Yes, he is. You know, none of Bernard's attempts to cure Mark worked with various experimental treatments and whatnot. So he's, you know, he's still odd. He's still autistic. But everybody in town loves him. He lives in a neighborhood in San Diego called Kensington, and his nickname in town is the Mayor of Kensington. And when we walked down the street, everybody said hi to him. Like, they either said, hey, Mark, or they said, hey, Mayor, or whatever, you know. And they love him. And, yes, they know he's weird, you know. Not all of them know that he played this instrumental role in the history of autism, because Bernard really launched the parents' the autism parents' movement, because he had been so mistreated by psychiatrists, and he knew that parents of autistic kids all over the country were being blamed for their kids' autism. And so Bernard and this woman, Ruth Christ Sullivan, launched the autism parents' movement. And so, you know, Mark turned out good. And when I asked Gloria, she doesn't usually give interviews about autism anymore, because there's so much, you know, controversy and mishigas, as they say, about autism. But she gave me an interview, and when I said to her, "Is there one thing that you wish you'd known about Mark when he was a kid?" and she said, "How well he would turn out."
That's great.
So that was great. That was wonderfully heartwarming.
I was going to ask you: are autistic children that become adults, can they live, you know, long, fruitful lives? I mean, will they live to an old age?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing terminal about autism or whatever. The really important thing is whether or not they get adequate support and, you know, find a good community that helps them with their self-care. And so, you know, basically, if they're not put in an institution, if they can live on their own, and if they have jobs that engage, if they can get a job and have jobs that engage their minds, then oftentimes middle age, in a way, can turn out to be an amazingly fruitful time for autistic people. Have you ever heard of a woman named Temple Grandin?
I have not.
She is probably the most famous autistic person in the world, and easily the most famous autistic woman in the world. There was an HBO documentary made about her in which Claire Danes played her. But anyway, when she was a kid, she was very, very difficult. And her mother was told that, you know, she should dump Temple in an institution. And, you know, her mother refused to do it. And her mother was told that Temple would never learn anything because autistic kids don't learn. And Temple was, you know, her autistic fascination was with, believe it or not, barnyard animals. So she would go to her aunt's farm, and she really related to the cows, which is actually not so unusual for autistic people to relate well to animals. So anyway, Temple ended up building this machine that looked like this machine that is used to calm cows down, basically, before they have to go through some medical procedure. It's a squeeze machine. So she wondered if a squeeze machine for her would help her anxiety. So as a teenager, she built one, and it worked. She felt great. And, you know, of course, when she reported this to the school psychologist, the school psychologist said, we don't think we're a cow, do we? You know, and so the school, you know, the school psychologist treated her like she was crazy because autism back then was considered some kind of emotional disturbance, you know, caused by bad parenting, as I say. But anyway, so by following her own special fascination with stockyards and cows and, you know, livestock equipment, she ended up becoming one of the leading industrial designers of equipment for handling livestock in the world. So she has a PhD. She's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She's written many, many books, both about autism and about livestock. And she's a reigning authority in her field. And yet when she was young, she was told that her mother was told that she would never amount to anything. So you never know, you know, some autistic kids are going to need care, you know, for the rest of their lives and will never be able to live independently. But it's really hard to tell from how they're behaving when they're three. I mean, I don't know if one could have predicted that I would turn out to be a science writer when I was three. But, you know, sometimes autistic kids, you know, are very self-injurious or really exhibit a lot of really difficult behaviors when they're young. But you cannot tell what their potential is until they're given the support they need, right, and then allowed to live it out. So I always tell parents, you know, don't limit your sense of your kid's potential because you never know what they're going to turn out to be.
That's true. And I bet, though, you loved science when you were a kid.
That is true. I collected minerals. I remember I had a mineral collection with a chunk of uranium in it. So you probably couldn't do that now.
No.
I hope I didn't hold it in my lap for too long.
My gosh, yeah. Have you been able to have kids?
I haven't had kids yet.
Uh-huh. Maybe you had it in the lap too long. You never
right,
know.
Exactly. Right.
Let me ask you probably one of the most controversial aspects of autism, and we've talked about it on this program over the years.
Yeah.
The fact that autism may be created from vaccines. And we've had guests on, Steve, who believe that something in some of the vaccines has gone wrong and kids have become autistic because of it. You've looked at it. What's your side of it? What have you found?
Well, okay.
And it is controversial, very controversial.
Yes, I'm going to bunt a little bit on that question, but I am going to say I completely understand why parents feel that way.
Okay.
For one reason, autism often doesn't become obvious until the kids are two or three, you know, exactly the same age that they'd be getting a round of vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And some kids have bad reactions to vaccines. And if the parent doesn't notice that the kid is autistic until after the kid has had a bad reaction to a vaccine, it would be very possible for a parent to feel that way. And I'm not going to dispute any parent's sense of what happened to their own kids. But I will say this. Let me play devil's advocate to myself and say, yes, you know, vaccines cause autism in some subset of kids. I don't personally believe that. But, you know, just for the purpose of talking about it here, let's say that. Here's the thing. I wrote about something else. I didn't really write about vaccines. I didn't deal with the vaccine controversy that much, although, of course, I mention it. But what I wrote about is something else. And the something else that I wrote about definitely accounts for a huge rise in the reported cases of autism in the last 30 years. So, in other words, and I'll tell you what that is shortly, but in other words, even if it's true that vaccines cause autism in a subset of kids, you must also account for what I wrote about, because, basically whatever else is happening other than what I wrote about is a little tipped layer on top of this iceberg of diagnoses that was created by what I wrote about, and let me tell you what it is.
Sure.
What it is that I discovered that the basic timeline of autism's discovery, as it is reported in hundreds of textbooks, Wikipedia, you know, many, many books on autism history, that was wrong. And, do we have enough time right now in this segment?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, you do.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Okay, here's the deal. What most people believe is that autism was discovered in 1943 by a child psychiatrist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore named Leo Kanner. His name looks like Kanner, but he pronounced it Kanner. He was Jewish. He was from Eastern Europe. And what's hilarious is that for a while he worked in a mental hospital, and some of the schizophrenic patients called him Father O'Connor, even though he was actually Jewish. Anyway, so people believe that he made this discovery because in 1943, he published a paper describing 11 autistic children, and that is seen as kind of the landmark discovery of autism. And then there's this, you know, interesting footnote to that discovery, which is that this guy named Hans Asperger in Vienna a year later published a paper allegedly describing 4 children, and that's just, you know, seen as kind of a footnote to Kanner's discovery. Okay, that's not what happened, actually, I discovered in my book, Neurotribes. I discovered that what happened is that Hans Asperger discovered autism in the 1930s, in the late 1930s. He wrote beautiful descriptions of autistic children. He worked in a clinic at the University of Vienna that was really a model of the way autistic kids should be treated today, which is it was a residential school as much as it was a clinic. The staff basically lived with the kids so they could observe them in, you know, every moment of their lives and all significant interactions and figure out what they needed really to help them thrive. There were classes at the clinic, there were music classes, there was a PE, there was a nun there named Sister Victorine Zach, who seemed to really be able to get these kids, and she had them dancing and listening to music, and Asperger would come in and read to the children. It was a very beautiful place. But ask yourself, what was going on in Vienna in the late 1930s? What was going on was that the Nazis marched into Austria and took it over. And the Nazis had a very different agenda for kids with, you know, inheritable disorders.
Oh, yes, they did.
Yeah, they did. And that agenda was extermination. And so there was a secret extermination program against children with all sorts of disabilities. The word autism wasn't invented yet, so... but they were exterminating kids with epilepsy, and many, many autistic kids have epileptic seizures. So there were probably a lot of autistic kids who were diagnosed with epilepsy. They were exterminating kids with schizophrenia. Schizophrenia was probably a label that was applied to autistic kids before the label autism was developed. And, of course, you know, kids who were in wheelchairs, whatever, forget it. Like, basically, these kids were left outside, you know, of these killing centers until they got pneumonia, and then the parents would get, you know, a death certificate and a bill for the cremation.
Oh.
Like, it was unbelievable. And those parts of my book are very, very dark. So here's the deal. Asperger did everything he could to protect the children in his clinic from extermination. And in fact, the Gestapo came to his clinic 3 times to arrest him. But Asperger had a sort of an ace in the hole, which is that his supervisor, who had appointed him to that job in the clinic, loved him and thought he was great. And his supervisor was also a huge, prominent Nazi who loved Hitler. So this guy basically was able to protect Asperger while Asperger protected the kids in his clinic. So it's an amazing, heroic story that has never been told yet, except in my book. But here's the really interesting thing. So obviously, during that time period, you know, while the Holocaust is going on, in a sense, the extermination program of children and disabled people was like a dry run for the Holocaust. The Nazis literally were developing means of mass killing, you know, figuring out a way, and they had to figure out, like, you know, where do you put the bodies when, you know, all the railroads are filled with military equipment? So it's like they had to figure out the whole scenario of how you kill people en masse, and they practiced on these disabled people.
Oh, that's it. Steve, we're going to talk more and take some phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.